This is the Jabberjaw Podcast Network.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Lead Singer Syndrome. I'm your host, Shane Told. This podcast is all about me talking to other lead singers about what it's like to front a rock and roll band. And today, we have a great episode. My friend Joel Birch of the Amity Affliction joins me. What can I say about them? I mean, I'm sure by now, pretty much wherever you're listening to this in the world, if you're into metalcore, hardcore, whatever, you know about the Amity Affliction. But it's kind of an interesting story because this band is massive in Australia. They have had now 3 number one albums in a row, which we talk about a little bit in the podcast. And now they're starting to pop off other places in the world. They've been doing really well in Europe for a while. Now they're on a bus tour in the US headlining. So it's really, really great to see everyone coming around and embracing the Amity Affliction, a great band. Before we get into my chat with Joel, I want to remind you guys, it's very easy to get in touch. If you've got suggestions for the show, if you want to give me some love, we've got all these different ways of doing it through social media. So please, if you got a Snapchat, I'm on there. It's Real Shane Told. Instagram is at Lead Singer Syndrome. Twitter is at Lead Singer Syn, S-Y-N. And if you just want to email me, go ahead. It's Lead Singer Syndrome @gmail.com. Also, Facebook. Facebook's a thing again. Just search for Lead Singer Syndrome. I'm sure it'll pop up. Go on the page. Give us a like. I'm going to be a lot more interactive on there very soon with Facebook. And part of it is we're going to be starting up the VIP club really soon. And I know I've been talking about it for a few weeks now, but it's coming. We're ironing out the details. So make sure, again, you're following us on the social media and all that shit so you know exactly what's happening. First of all, got to give a big shout out to the 2016 Toronto Blue Jays. Yes, applause, insert applause. They have swept the Texas Rangers, a team that I cannot stand. So that is a beautiful thing. I was at the game last night, and as a huge baseball fan, I just couldn't be happier. And in other news with me, I am launching my first ever solo tour for my side project, River Oaks. It's not a big tour. I'm only playing 5 shows. They are Detroit, Cleveland, Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, and New York. If you're in any of those cities, please check out riveroaksmusic.com for tickets. I'm bringing out my friend Mark Rose, who used to be the frontman of Spitalfield, who we really should have on this podcast. I'm going to call Mark. We're going to get Mark on this podcast for sure. But that tour is happening. There are VIP tickets. There are regular tickets. So please check it out. Again, it's riveroaksmusic.com. And Silverstein is going back on tour this weekend. We're going out with Memphis May Fire, The Devil Wears Prada, and Lake Mazda Flames. It is the Rise Up Tour because we're all on Rise Records. So it is going to be a good time. And yeah, we're coming to pretty much all the major cities on the East Coast, a lot of the cities in the South, and California and Texas. So check that out as well. Just go over to silversteinmusic.com. We got all the dates up there. And make sure you get tickets for that as well. Also, if you like the podcast and you want to support the show, we got bills to pay. We got to keep the lights on, so to speak. So if you want to help out, it's really easy. You don't have to do anything directly. We aren't taking any donations or anything at this time. If you buy anything online at all, and you use Amazon, just go to leadsingersyndrome.com/Amazon. That will take you right to the Amazon homepage. Log in as normal. And whenever you buy, we get 4-6%. It really helps out. Every little bit counts. So once again, that is leadsingersyndrome.com/Amazon. Anyway, let's get into it. Here is my conversation with Joel Birch of the Amity Affliction. Will you miss me when I'm gone?
here with Joel Birch, the Amity Affliction in Toronto. I'm having a patio beer in a very hip mason jar that just says Coors on it, which is kind of cancels out the coolness.
Well, hey, maybe it's like a low-key juxtaposition.
Yeah, something like that.
The good and the bad.
I think the banquet thing they're doing with the gold cans are like is like their attempt at being cool, like a vintage thing.
I don't think that would fly in the Silverstein camp.
No, you know how we roll.
Yeah.
We're total beer snobs. Total beer snobs. But well, dude, it's just crazy. Like, you guys are back. Another new record just came out. What, a month ago? 2 months ago, almost.
Yeah, nearly 2 months.
How's it been back on tour? In North America?
Good. It's good. I mean, it's picking up. We've been coming here for like 6 years and
yeah,
it's finally starting to pick up, which is nice. But yeah, I mean, it's hard for me. It's the longest tour I've done away from my son and been pretty difficult, pretty homesick.
Yeah.
But I mean, as far as the shows go, it's been great. Great success so far. And
well, it's interesting you bring up the fact that you been coming here for 6 years and now it's like just starting to pick up. And one thing that always struck me about you guys is like when we did that tour a few years ago with Bless the Fall.
Yeah.
You know, you guys were second of four. We were playing right after you. You guys have back-to-back number one records in Australia, yet you can still suck it up and go to America and tour in a van.
Yeah. Well, you got to do it. And
right,
I think,
but a lot of bands would say, you know what, we're fucking rock stars in Australia, we're huge, we got 2 number one records in a row, now 3 number one records in a row.
Yeah.
A lot of bands would just be like, we don't need that, we don't need America, why don't they get us? You know, why is this such a struggle over there? And you guys have actually been like, no, we have to put in the work.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we were together for 6 years before, or as far as, you know, me being the singer for six years before we started touring over here. And that's about the same time it took us to get our success, or, you know, to start the wheels turning for success in Australia. So I feel like we're on a similar schedule over here. It's just that we, being so far removed from North America, it's like financially very difficult to tour over here.
Sure.
So we weren't making anywhere near enough money until then to actually afford flying to America and
of course
and spending months at a time over here.
Well, I didn't even bring up the financial thing. You know, I was talking more just like of a straight up like ego perspective. But financially, well, absolutely, I mean, it's far away.
I don't think ego has ever really played into our band. I think the where ego would play into our band would be internally. You know what I mean? And not in a egos versing each other, but we're very proud of what we've done, and we keep that within our band. Like, we're all very proud of our achievements and everything like that, but we don't feel like we need to gloat about it either.
No, I get that. I mean, I've known you guys a very long time now.
Yeah.
It's funny, I remember our first tour. It was, what year was that? 2008, I want to say?
2009, and we played in the UK, I think. Oh, no.
No, the tour in Australia.
Oh, 2008,
When it was Set Your
Troy,
Goals.
Yeah, Boys of Summer.
And one thing that I thought was funny is, years later, you guys thought we didn't like you or something.
Because of Bill.
What's the story there?
Because we're tight with JJ, and you guys are tight with JJ, obviously, from Prom Queen days. And we went up to, I don't know what was going on. We're in the UK. We played the one-off show in the UK, and JJ had said, oh, go say hi to Bill for me. And we were like, hey, JJ said hi, and he was in a foul mood and just brushed us off. And we were like, oh, all right. And then, so we went into the Australian tour just like, oh, well, they don't like us, so fuck it.
Oh, that's what it is.
Yeah.
Okay, no. Well, sorry. And Billy's like the most friendly guy ever. And surprised.
Yeah, and then we tour together years later, and he's just like, I don't know what you're talking about. And they're like...
No, but the Australian tour is funny because you guys thought we were like a Christian band and we were offended with the things you were saying or something.
Yeah, that I don't know who told you that. Maybe that was Troy. Troy's you could have been told anything by him. It would have been a fantastic story, I'm sure.
Well, I like fantastic stories.
Well, they're very fantastic. And they change. It's great. They morph into different stories.
But I thought that was cool. And, you know, we had kind of had an introduction to each other back then, and, you know, I've watched you guys grow. And I remember another thing that happened with you guys was you guys played the Soundwave tour. I think it was 2009, maybe. But at that time, you were one of the only Australian bands on it. Every other band was international.
Yeah, Parkway did that first, so they did the Soundwave tour. That might... Yeah, so we didn't do Soundwave until we must have done 2012.
Oh, maybe it's 2011 then, because we were on the same year as you guys.
Yeah,
so.
I don't know, 11 or 12. We must have done 11 and 13.
Right, so this was 11 then. So in 2011 you did Soundwave.
Yeah.
And at that time, was it a big deal that you guys got that being basically the only Australian band?
Yeah, and it was weird because there was a lot of... I don't know how to, like, everyone was really pissed off at AJ for not putting Australian bands on.
Yeah.
And simultaneously crushing the touring industry in Australia.
Yeah.
So it's only just started to sort of pick back up with bands doing headline tours, but basically you had 100 bands on this thing and there was no point in any North American band or any European band coming out on their own because they'd make so much more money coming out to Soundwave. Whether they got paid or not is a different story, but the offer on the table was much better than coming out and risking your own skin, you know what I mean? And,
absolutely.
And so everyone was really pissed off, and we got underpaid like a motherfucker on both Soundwave runs we did. Afterwards, AJ kept saying, you know, because kids would be like, why aren't you doing Soundwave? And AJ would be like, oh, they're part of the Soundwave family, you know, like they're always welcome back. And we're like, motherfucker, like, why would we do it for, like, less than the least paid U.S. band, you know? Like, that you're bringing out as a favor.
Local discount, yeah.
Yeah,
right,
you know
course.
What I mean?
Yeah.
And so there was that, and I think just... Yeah, I mean, it was a huge deal, and it was, at the same time, a bit upsetting.
Right. It's funny.
But that shows the promoter attitude in Australia, I think.
Well, Australia, that was a really fucking weird time. And, you know, we came over in Australia quite early in our career. Like, we came in 2005.
Yeah.
With Destroy All Lines brought us over.
Yeah, I remember that tour.
Yeah, like, with Behind Crimson Eyes, was
it?
Yeah. Our first show ever in Australia was in Brisbane.
Yeah.
So...
At the Rev, I believe.
Yeah. Were you there at the show?
Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah.
That rules. But anyways, we came over and, like, right away, we're like, this is the best. This country rules. People are cool here. People understand hardcore and...
Like Canadians.
And what we're trying to do. Like Canadians, maybe.
Yeah, it's very similar, I feel.
Small countries, but big countries.
Yeah. Huge landmass.
That's right.
Small population.
Yeah. But, so we kind of made it a habit of trying to come back to Australia as much as we could. You know, at least every 2 years.
Yeah.
And then we did the Soundwave. We did it once. It was great. And we're like, okay, so we got to play like a 30-minute set. There's a shitload of people watching us. We want to come back and do like our own tour.
Yeah.
So that our fans that we made can come see us. So we say to AJ, hey, man, can we come back and do our own tour? Oh, not interested in bringing you guys back like on your own.
Yeah.
Okay. He's like, just do Sound. We'll just do have you on Soundwave again. So we're like, well... All right, okay. So it's 2011, we do Soundwave. It's great again.
Yeah.
30-minute set. And then after that, we say the same thing. And he's like, no, I'm not interested in bringing you back. And we say, okay, well, is there another promoter that would do our tour?
Yeah.
And he goes, fuck you guys. Fuck you assholes. Like, what are we supposed to do? Just wait for you every 2 years and play a 30-minute set?
Yeah.
In a country that we love being in, we actually have fans?
And you've been going there for 6 years or 5 years previously.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So he took ownership of the whole fucking scene. It was very
exactly.
upsetting.
Exactly. And now I don't know what he's doing or...
So Soundwave was just the last in a line of, like, musical promotion failures for him. I guess.
Okay.
Booming success, followed by, I guess, a lot of coke, and then, you know, like, failure as an enterprise. I don't know what he's doing now. He still sort of tweets from time to time, but...
Well, I mean, they had that list released of all those bands that were owed.
He hasn't paid,
like, insane amounts of money. Millions, like, hundreds, millions of dollars.
Yeah, I think millions of dollars total, but... I really don't know what he's doing. I wouldn't be surprised if he comes back and does it again. It seems to be the way for music, is that the whole music scene will happily get fucked over and then go back to the same people, you know?
It's a weird place we live in.
It is, yeah.
It's a weird world.
Yeah.
You guys... have you guys done an Australian tour? We'll wait for that motorcycle. Have you guys done an Australia tour yet on this new record?
We have, but it was like a smaller, like an underplay tour.
Yep.
So it was, in all honesty, a tour just to do the album tour first in Australia, for the Australian people.
Yep.
Otherwise, there wouldn't have been a tour for like a year after the CD came out, or album. I don't even know what you call it anymore. You call it a record? You call it...
Well, yeah, what is it?
I mean, it's going back to vinyl, but it's digital. Do you say my new Spotify album came out?
I know, right?
My new Apple Music album came out. My new fucking Tidal album came out.
CD, album, record, whatever. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I like that everything's coming full cycle and people are buying vinyl again. And it's like, when tapes came out, they were like, oh, vinyl's dead. And then CDs came out and they're like, oh, cassettes are dead. And now it's like CDs are dead. It's like nothing ever
dies.
Tapes
are back, too.
Tapes are back, which is ridiculous. Yeah, they sound like shit. I just do not understand it.
They sound like shit. They wear out. And like, part of why vinyl's cool is because you get a huge version of the artwork, too.
Yeah.
From it, like, you know, you just pull out your iPad Pro, like you're an artist.
Yeah. I love it.
That's the best.
It's, yeah, and it's tactile. You get to hold it. You get, yeah. I like, it's like a ritual, you know, like you take it out, you put it on, you look at the artwork, read the lyrics while you're listening to it. You have to flip it over. Like, I like that whole, it is like a full on musical ritual, you know.
When you guys write albums, do you think about side A and side B, even though, you know, for the most part, people aren't...
I don't think we have until this one.
Yeah.
So this one was like all fucked up plays, and it's a good time on the album to flip it, you know, because then it's like starting afresh on the other side. So this would be the first time that we've thought about it.
Yeah, we've actually always done that. We've always thought about a record in two halves, like almost like two EPs almost.
That's way more relaxing, I feel. Like, that's less stressful.
Oh, yeah.
As far as picking songs goes, because you just pick the first half and then the second half. That's nice.
That's what we always done, but it is interesting now. I'm sure a lot of bands will start to think that way.
Yeah.
About, you know, when, where maybe they haven't, because, you know, it's been a CD world, and now it's not a CD world at all.
No. And now, you know, I think now you're lucky if the listener, if they didn't buy the vinyl, if they make it to the last track, to be honest, you know what I mean?
It's true.
Like, you put something on in your car, you drive 10 minutes down the road, you get back in the car, you feel like something else.
Dude, I'm so guilty
over
of that,
and over
man,
and over.
Even myself.
So am I. And, you know, I think, haven't they reduced the number of songs it takes to be classified as an album down to 8 or something? Or is it 6? It's something stupid.
Oh, serious? I didn't know that was even a classification.
Yeah, so... Because I know I bought a record by Vic Mensa, this rapper, and his album's 8 songs. And I was like, what the fuck? Like, 8 songs? Are you serious? But then I was like, well, if it was, you know, like old rap CDs were like 18, 19 tracks with 10
interludes
tracks of
and
bullshit,
shit
you know?
Yeah, exactly. It's true.
Like the old Wu-Tang albums, you're like, oh my God, there's 30 tracks on this thing, but it's like... an hour of shinfo.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I kind of like that about that, like, old school hip hop. Yeah. I liked all the bullshit tracks.
So
like,
many interludes.
The Alcoholics and, like, bands like that. Like, I love that kind of, that era of rap, man. But back to Australia, like, obviously, I mentioned, and I'm sure most people will know this, but you guys are obviously have a very, very successful band in Australia. This is your third number one album in a row, which is fucked.
Yeah, I think there's only 5 Australian bands or something that have
ever done
that. And then 10 acts that have ever done that or something in Australia.
Has anyone ever done four? Four in a row?
I'm not sure. I've got no idea.
It's just that kind of success is so nuts. And, like, you know, you must kind of feel like you have the country, like, in the palm of your hand.
No.
But is it?
No.
You don't feel like that?
No. Australia is so apathetic. So shit can just turn on a dime. Which is a funny saying to use when talking about Australia, but it's true. It's like...
But it hasn't for three albums.
It hasn't, and I... Like, I don't know what it is. Like, I hope that we've reached a point where... we can retain the size that we're at, obviously. Obviously, that's what every musician hopes for. But I think... As well, we already have in the back of our mind that the next album's got to be the changing album,
right?
For us, like the mature. This was, I feel like, this album that we just put out is like the mature finale to the sound that we've had thus far, and then the next one is where we need to sort of.
Yeah, I read that you said. What did you say? Something. You basically said this is going to be the last album, kind of. Talking about your depression and your anxiety, and you're going to go more into like a conceptual based
theme. Well, I'm hoping to. I think a lot of that, I mean, it's not completely tied to my alcoholism, but a lot of that would be tied to being an alcoholic. And even though I'm dealing with depression still and still on medication and still have the effects of depression daily, it's far more manageable than when I was drinking every day.
Right.
Which is a standard, you know, that's a given. Because if you're hungover, you're at a very vulnerable state. And I was either hungover or wasted. So I don't know that it'll ever completely disappear from the content of our music and the subject matter, but I think there'll be a metamorphosis into some sort of other delivery.
So you're completely sober now?
Yeah.
For how long?
7 months, I think. Nearly 7 months. 7 months tomorrow.
Good for you.
Yeah, cheers.
You feel... How difficult was that initially?
It wasn't difficult at all because I was in a situation where it was either give up drinking or lose my family. So as is the case with most alcoholics that actually make a change, everything was falling to pieces. You know, including my, maybe not my position in the band, but my standing in the band as a person was starting to take a dive as well.
You mean the relationship with your other band members?
Yeah. And, I couldn't see that at the time, but I think almost immediately when I stopped drinking and started to reflect on everything, it was very clear that I was really... really on the decline, you know, as a human being, just in my relationships, my relationships with my friends, my band, my wife, my children, like everything was taking a hit, all for, you know, quote unquote, the party.
Right.
And I think it had really ceased to be a party by this time. So, that had a lot to do with my mental state in writing lyrics, but I've always been a fan of the sadder side of music. So I can't see from when I was very young. So I can't see that being something that I'm ever removed from. You know.
Well, I mean, other than just sorry, go ahead.
Oh no, I was just gonna say it's not like we were gonna write a fucking Bee Gees album, you know? Like,
right, of course, right. There's also like a certain mechanism though, like you've written what, 5 records with just this band, not to mention everything else you've written or worked on, and you've always had this sort of underlying theme that when you sit down with a pen and a paper, you're going to write a certain style. And I don't think that that's just something that you can just lose whether you want to or not.
Not at all. And I haven't changed what I've written about ever. So since joining bands, I've written about the same thing, because that's I feel that if you're writing songs, you need to be writing about what you feel. Either that, or you need to be specifically writing about what you believe in. And if not that, then you need to be writing as a performance piece.
Right.
So someone like Nick Cave, for instance, is more a performance and observatory music. Do you know what I mean? Like, he's making observations on the world and writing about them.
Yes.
And that's his style. And then you've got, you know, like, even, and I hate to say it, Limp Bizkit. That's like a theater piece, you know what I mean? Like, they're like a performance-based band. And, you know, each band has to find what they're about, and then,
right.
And then you follow that. And
right, you think of, like, comedy acts and stuff, like, that's, you know.
Yeah, it's all subjective, so.
Sure.
There's that, and I don't think I could just up and change the way I write, but I want to change the way it's delivered.
Sure. Well, I mean, that's a challenge. That'll be a challenge for you, and you know, I mean, it'll probably be something you have to work harder on, but.
Absolutely.
At the same time, like, you say you went from drinking every day, you know, basically either being wasted or hungover. Do you have more time on your hands? Are you feeling
so
like you're
more
productive?
Time. Yeah, so much more time. I had my father over recently, and he's been sober for 12 years, so he was an alcoholic as well. And he also commented on time. He's like, "What now? What do you do with all your time?" He's like, "You've got so much time now." And I was like, "You really do." Like, you wake up and you're like, "Wow, there's where there used to be, you know, a few hours until you'd start drinking. Now there's 12 hours of." You know, like, what do I do with this time? So I've been drawing a lot more. I've been painting a lot more. So I've been significantly more productive. And where previously I may have only written lyrics leading up to the recording, I've been writing lyrics
all the time.
Or writing poetry outside of it.
Right.
So you're right, it will be a challenge. And I think that a big part of the challenge will be getting it to Aaron and convincing him to like go with the change as well, because there is a tendency with bands to get formulaic, and once you've got a winning formula, to not change it. So I think the next album is the right one to do it, because Dan and Aaron are thinking that we need to do that musically, as I am and Ryan. And so I think that's a good time to make the lyrical leap to the next phase as well.
It's interesting, you know, you bring up the winning formula, and I don't want to say your band has a formula, but
we have
if you had to describe it, it'd be like verse, Joel,
it's
screaming,
a, it's, I think
chorus
it's like,
kicks in,
yeah,
aren't all pretty,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
There is a formula to that. So
yeah.
Are you
I
scared
think,
that if you break that mold, you're just going to alienate your fan base and people are going to be pissed, or do you think there's a way to do it?
There's a tasteful way to do everything, yeah. I feel. Like, we're not going to put out a dance record, for instance. You know what I mean? Like, that's an extreme thing to say, but that's how people view it when a band changes their sound. They're like, what is this bullshit? Like, you know, like, what are you doing? Unless it's gradual. So we can't make a leap on the next record. For 11 tracks.
Right.
We can do it for two, you know what I mean? And then let the others be more gradual, but we certainly can't come out with 11 new songs that are like, I mean, we can.
Very few bands have been able to pull that off.
I mean, we can do that, but it would be at our own peril, you know? Like.
Well, you're very self-aware, Joel.
I
appreciate that, and I appreciate the honesty, you know, because a lot of bands would sit here and bullshit and say, no, man, we're passionate about our new sound. And then you're like, well, you definitely were a little more calculated than that.
Yeah,
you know,
well, I mean,
when bands change.
Yeah, like we're ready to change. We're getting older, you know. Aaron's just hit 30. So I never thought that when you, like, being in a band, you tend to age less so mentally, I feel, than people in the real world.
Do you think so? Because I have two takes on it, but I'll let you finish.
All right. In one sense, yes. In one sense, no.
Yeah.
In one sense, you become far more cultured because you're well traveled. So you get. I think you gather a more mature understanding of how the world works being in a band.
Like life experience.
Yeah, life experience. But I also think that some of the milestones that your peers may reach earlier than you in maturing. And for some things, that is going to reflect musically, I feel. So Aaron's just hit 30. I'm 34. I've reached the stage where I've been ready for our music to change maybe a little while ago.
Right.
But in a different direction to Aaron. And I think he's at the stage now where our ideas are starting to merge a little. And I think that's got something to do with age. I'm not sure what the correlation would be, but it's like there's something about him getting older and our ideas lining up more where they lined up perfectly when we were younger. So I think there's a gap because we're 4 years apart.
Yeah.
So I think that's at some point that came into play in our taste in music and stuff like that. He's starting to like a lot of the stuff I started to like when I was 30, a lot of the softer, more ballad-driven pop music like The National and stuff like that.
Yeah.
However, he's had a more mature taste in so far as listening to old folk music and stuff than I have. So
right.
It's really hard to sort of articulate what I'm getting at, but I've noticed a change in him that I only noticed in myself when I hit 30. So I think the next record will be a reflection of that.
Yeah. Well, you did a little bit of different vocal style on a couple songs on this record, right? There's a little bit of clean singing that you did for the first time.
Yeah. Not clean, just different.
Different.
Yeah.
Is that something that you think could take a new role in the band moving
Absolutely.
Forward?
Absolutely. And, you know, I am, like I said, I'm 34. I'm getting a little bit sick of the same thing. So,
yeah.
Not sick of music at all. Not sick of playing live at all, but sick of just screaming. Like, it's time to, you know, like any art form, there is a time where you need to branch out a little bit. You know, even no fine artist will paint the same picture for 20 years. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I get that. Totally get that analogy. Yeah.
And it is an analogy because I don't think what we're producing is fine art at all. But it may be popular in a niche, but it will remain a niche for quite a few years to come, I believe. But I think it's time for some maturing and for our music to reflect our age. And
you guys have so much mainstream success, but yet you guys still have like all your singles and stuff still have screaming. It's still like relatively radio inaccessible from a traditional standpoint. Do you guys have a lot of radio play in Australia?
Yeah, I mean, on Triple J for sure.
Yeah.
But they've always been one to buck the, you know, until recently, I'll say they've always been one to buck the trend. But the EDM movement has just put dance music on every fucking radio station in the world, from what I can understand. You know, you used to, but I mean, maybe that's the old jaded part of me speaking, because back when I was younger, turning on Triple J would mean Sonic Youth and Nirvana and
right.
all these great bands, but I guess that was the counterculture revolution of the time. And I guess EDM is, it didn't come from popular culture.
I guess so.
I suppose. I don't know.
Yeah, I guess so.
I don't like it. At all, but
I don't really know much about it.
I don't know anything about it.
I kind of just ignore it.
I watched the Steve Aoki documentary and was still confused about how it even happened. But
yeah,
but that guy's the man. I'll say I will say that I had no feeling either way about him. But he's the man. But anyway, I'm getting off topic. Yes, we make music that you can't play on regular radio. We just got our first song on commercial radio back home.
What song is that?
All Fucked Up. but they
that's the title, dude.
Yeah, but we did a
radio song. But yeah,
we
but did still, how do they say the title on the air?
All messed up.
All messed up.
Yeah, and we sang messed up specifically because we're like, this could be the song that crosses over, kind of thing.
When you, I mean, coming from, all right, we're all in our 30s here.
Yeah.
Okay, we're adults.
Yeah.
We're realists.
Exactly.
And this is our job, and this is why we make money. We're not stupid, but coming from like the hardcore punk days, did you feel like a sellout?
Morally conflicted, yes. But I mean, I was discussing this with someone recently, and I was saying, what is more punk or more hardcore than sticking to what we've done for the longest period of time through the up and down of the screamo era?
Yeah, sure.
We haven't changed markedly, you know. We've perfected our sound. We've always said fuck you to our labels, no matter who the label was. We've done whatever we've wanted to do. We've done it our way. So I felt morally conflicted changing one word from fucked to messed, but it's also the only way that it would be possible to reach the next level of success. And I don't think success is selling out. If you're not sacrificing your message, then I don't believe that you're selling out.
Right.
And we've never sacrificed our message or our integrity, I feel.
I agree with you.
Yeah, and we've never done radio edits where we've cut out any substance from the song. We've turned down radio edits that have cut out meaningful parts of our songs.
Yeah.
So we've shunned enough, I feel, to make it okay for us.
On your own terms.
On our own terms, yeah.
No, I totally get that. That's one of those things. Like, I've always heard radio edits, you know, and when they don't just bleep it, like any, whether it's, you know, even the most mainstream stuff, and when you hear a line that's clearly saying, it's like they had the foresight in the studio to re-sing that line a different way. Like, you know, the artist was on board.
I think at this point in our career, and it is a career now, it would be stupid to not be thinking of these things.
Sure.
I think it would be irresponsible of us, of our own longevity.
Well, you got a family to support. And the other thing, too, that we haven't talked about yet is just the size of Australia. It's fucking small.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about five major cities. I mean, arguably five major cities.
I'd say four major cities.
Right.
Maybe even three, because, I mean, Adelaide is not big. For us to play to 10,000 in Brisbane, and then 2,000 in Adelaide, and consider that a very big success.
Yeah.
That says something about the size of the city.
And sure.
I'm not sure if it's still this way, but 5 years ago, I know it was the only city in Australia in decline.
Wow.
Yeah.
Everyone's leaving. Well, they got no fucking power down there. What do you want?
They're 8 hours from Melbourne. Like,
Melbourne's the best.
Yeah.
The best. Yeah, but, and I just lost track of where I was saying, but,
the size of the country.
The size of the country. And that must factor in because you guys just can't do that many tours.
No.
Like, you do a U.S. tour. Like, if a band does two U.S. tours a year, that's like...
That's an A market and a B market run.
An A market and a B market run. They can probably do that twice every year. And that's taking up a good 6 months.
Or more.
Of the year. And so you have success in America. You have lots of places to play, which is lots of work. But in Australia... You guys are probably lucky if you can do 10 to 12 shows a year.
We would never do that many. Not in capital cities.
I mean, like with festivals and supporting. And
if we do a festival, we don't do a tour that year.
Wow.
Yeah. It's too small. It's too much. So we toured. A lot of people over here, you know, in North America won't know how much we toured before success. So we toured for 8 or 9 months a year in Australia, which is, you've been there, you know, that's fucking crazy. So we were doing support after support. We'd go support, regional tour, support, regional tour, support, regional tour. And we'd do that as much as we could. Until we sold out 1,000 cap venues. We did hi-fis and stuff, which is what you guys do, I think, down there.
Yeah, I think so.
And, when we hit that point, we were like, all right, we've got to stop. Because you can thrash Australia to death.
Yes.
You can actually burn out your band. And a lot of bands have done that. And it's, you know, I think that's where the unwillingness to go overseas can shorten your career.
Is it unwillingness from bands, though, or is it more so inability?
Both. Sometimes it's both. Sometimes it's one. Sometimes it's the other. Some bands don't want to.
Yeah.
Some people, and it's, you know, if there's one member of a band that really doesn't want to leave home,
sure,
then that's that, you know.
Do you guys had aspirations to do that, though, as a band early on?
We've never
go to America, to go to Europe. Let's give it a second.
Yeah.
That's the Amity Affliction tour bus pulling away. Oh, straight out of Texas. There you go. Fuck the Texas Rangers. Anyways, where were we?
Our aspirations as far as touring goes have always been in the immediate future. So we didn't really think about touring outside of Australia until we had to.
Really?
Yeah. We didn't think past a certain point. It's like, let's just climb this, you know, one stair at a time kind of thing. So there is a top, I guess, but we've never looked at it. It's like, what's the next thing we do? So
step by step, and you realize how far you've come over a long period of time.
Yeah, so it was like, all right, you've done this, now you need to go overseas. Or you need to keep working regular jobs and tour once a year.
Right.
And it was like, well, that's a no-brainer. And so we went to the UK first, and that was in 2009. And then for some reason, I'd said, when we made the decision to go overseas, I said, let's do Europe and the UK more than the US. I was like, the US is harder to break.
Mm-hmm.
And so we did the exact opposite, of course, and started going to the US more. I was just speaking with one of our managers the other day, and he goes, I don't know why we did this way. And I was like, I beg your pardon? I was like, what? What, mate? Like, you don't know why we didn't do Europe and the UK first? Like, you motherfucker. I said that like 6 years ago. So I'm glad we did it this way, because I feel if we did it the other way, we may have never broken America, and America's a nice place to tour. Once you get to where we're at now, it's nice, you know.
Sure, when you have a bus and everything, because that's another thing people don't know is that in Australia you don't have buses.
No.
In Australia you have to basically fly.
You're in a van. You fly or you're in a van.
Yeah. Which is really weird, but it's just, I guess there's a lot, like seatbelt laws or whatever.
You're not allowed to sleep in a moving vehicle.
Okay. There you go. But is it weird for you guys having, again, so much success in Australia? You're putting on these massive shows, like you said, 10,000 in Brisbane, and then you come over here and you're playing sometimes
200.
Like a 250 cap room. Like, there's no lights, there's no production at all. Is it change, like, you have to adapt to your show and what you do as a front man?
Yeah. But if we didn't come from the hardcore scene, it would be a lot tougher.
Yeah.
But we did. So, it, you know, it is what it is. And those shows are fun. So, I mean, there's a part of me that likes both sides of the coin.
And the variation probably keeps it interesting.
Yeah, it's, you know, and it keeps you grounded as well. And
definitely,
you know, you've got to have humility in any field, and it's definitely a way to keep you in check, you know.
Well, I think that's the first question I asked you was when you guys are coming over here playing to 10,000 people in Australia and then you're in a van.
Yeah.
You know, playing 2 of 4.
I don't really give a fuck, to be honest. I mean, it is what it is, you know.
But I mean, you talked about integrity, and that's another thing, like, you know, I've known you for a long time, and you're not scared to call people out on their shit.
No.
You're not scared of anybody, and you are not scared to ruffle feathers, and you're not going to kiss anyone's ass.
No.
And I have a lot of respect for you on that accord, but have there been bridges you burned, or has it really not mattered to you?
Because
you are somewhat calculated in, like, worrying about success and thinking about success. So that side of you is almost a little bit of the opposite, in that you'll just fucking call out Matty Mullins or whoever, you know, like, you don't care.
No, I don't care. And I really don't. And So I did that, and I went straight to production of Warped afterwards, and I said, look, I've said my piece, I won't say anything more about it, but I had to say it. And they were like,
okay.
They were like, all right, well, thanks for... You, obviously, they heard about it before we even got off stage.
Okay.
And they were like, all right, well, thanks. So what exactly thanks. Did you say? That's what I said.
You oh, said,
about Matty Mullins?
Yeah.
I don't know. People... He was making really sexist comments and about what women were wearing. I think, you know, there were... It's fucking summer, man. Like, it's hot. Like... Dudes are getting around in you know, like what's considered funny outfits with a hat and just the shorter shorts they can wear, and flip flops, and people are like, oh, that's funny. But if a chick wears the same thing, it's like, oh, she's a slut. And it's like, maybe she's fucking hot, dude. It's summer. Like, go fuck yourself. And it was just a series of unfortunate events for him, I think, because I just heard their song Jezebel the day before, which is basically slut shaming. And then he made some disparaging comments about, you know, girls coming onto him and what they were wearing. And I was just like, why is the responsibility and the onus on the female to dress a certain way and act a certain way? Like, it takes two to tango. Like, go fuck yourself, basically. Anyway, it just pissed me off. I don't like that, you know. And I think as well, I was already pissed off because there'd been a racist incident at one of our signings, and I was just in the mood, you know.
A racist incident with Chad?
Yeah, with Chad.
Really?
Yeah.
That's so fucked up.
Yeah. So, you know, it was an Australian guy, and I don't think he was thinking, and I really don't believe this guy was inherently racist, but he made a very distasteful joke that we didn't hear.
Oh.
And Chad went straight into a really dark mood, and we were like, we didn't know what happened, and we got back to the bus.
Oh, I remember what this is. I won't name the guy, but I remember what happened. Yeah.
And he, so he told us what happened, and I was furious. So I was just like, this is just really, really inappropriate and not funny at all. And so this all happened leading up to us playing. So it was just a big storm of shit brewing. And I think right before we played, someone had said, oh, did you hear this? And I was like, just saw red, you know. I was like, I've had enough with this shit. And so I said what I said, and you know, last Warped Tour, I approached Matt and I said, you know, there's no beef here,
right?
I don't, you know.
Well, I mean, we're going on tour with Memphis May Fire in a week, so. And I mean, talking about Matty Mullins, which is funny guy to bring up all of a sudden out of nowhere, but you know, on Warped Tour, he said that thing about being the voice of a generation. Do you remember that? And I called him out on that, you know, and I said like that. I thought that was.
He's just said, you know, so much dumb shit. Like, this
think,
is just
I
a...
I think he, for him,
no,
it's more of a... I do think, at his core, Matty's a good guy. I don't think he's a bad guy at all. And I think sometimes he's trying to be inspirational. And I think maybe sometimes he doesn't think it all the way through. But he has apologized for that. And I've talked to him since. And I think he understands. Whatever.
Sure, I'll have another.
Yeah, is it? Sorry, I just ordered another beer in front of a recovering alcoholic. Which
I don't care.
Is not cool.
I encouraged the beer earlier, if you remember.
You did. Yeah. Is it hard to be around people drinking and like the whole party thing now?
No.
Because I was talking to Fat Mike from NoFX, and he was saying that was the hardest part for him. Like after a show, you have a great show, and people are kind of like celebrating, and you just feel like you're not.
Yeah, but the thing I realized is that I was celebrating, you know what I mean? Like celebrating another day of the week. So
right,
for, you know, it's for me, it's I think I'm a lot like my dad in many areas, and this is probably just one more to add to the list, is that he said once he's made up his mind, that's it. this is what I do now, and that's what I do. And now I don't drink, and that's just what I do. So, you know, I'm not even at 12 months yet, but I feel like I've already made the switch mentally from
good
from drinking to not drinking, and accepting that I was a piece of shit on the booze. Like, not everyone is a piece of shit when they drink, you know. And I think it brought out the malicious side of me, and
right.
I'm glad to let that go, you know.
The guys in your band have been supportive?
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah.
So with all this time you have on your hands now, you mentioned you're doing a lot of painting and art. Is that something you're going to try to do more of, or try to have a second, thing on the side? I know you already kind of do.
I already do, yeah.
Yeah, but I guess you can expand that a little more?
Yeah, I don't know. I do everything in equal measure, I feel, creatively. So, I don't know. I think that's how I've managed to not get sick of any of it. By doing so much, you know. Jack of all, master of none, and whatnot.
The new record, This Could Be Heartbreak, is out now. You worked with Will Putney again. How was that experience, and how was it for you vocally doing your thing?
I was drunk most of the time, so you were. I don't remember a lot of it.
Really? Actually don't remember?
Actually don't remember yet. But what I do remember, it was just normal. It's recording, you know, it's stressful, it's... But it is what it is.
So when you're, you say you're drunk, that's crazy. Like, so what, you just go in the vocal booth, and you've got some lyrics that you've written down, and you're just screaming them, and then they're just like, do it again, and you're just kind of doing what they say, and you're just sort of...
No, when I record, I definitely get into the moment of what I wrote. So, you know, it's not hard for me to revisit my lyrics when I'm performing them on a record.
So you'd say in the studio it's like emotional for you then?
Yeah.
when you're really pouring yourself into these songs.
Yeah.
That's I don't hear that a lot. Mm. You know, because I think a lot of bands, they get caught up in, we're in the studio, we're paying this much money, we gotta get the perfect take, is this song good, is this in time, you know, whatever, and they don't actually think about the whole point, which is expression and art.
Yeah.
So were you drunk because you needed to deal with that, or was it just you were just drunk?
I was just
drunk anyways.
I was just drunk anyways, I think, to be honest. I mean, I was drinking like a carton of beer and a bottle of wine, and waking up and then having a beer before going there, and you know, getting an Uber via the bottle shop every day, and rocking up with a carton of beer every day.
Yeah.
And
like, were the other guys in your band drinking too? Did they?
They were having like a beer.
Right. Did they realize the extent of your drinking and it was a problem for you? Did you ever talk to them about it?
I mean, probably, but it's been a problem for so many years that what's the difference? You know?
Right.
I think for sure it's been a problem in the past, and I've nearly drunk myself to death, you know, a couple of times. And
well, yeah, I mean, Warped Tour, that was kind of scary.
And so, you know, it's an obvious problem, but it took a cataclysmic life fuck-up to, you know, to make a change.
Right.
And in hindsight, you know, it's like, what kind of idiot nearly dies from drinking and then drinks again? An alcoholic does that. So, yeah. And, you know, repeatedly.
Right.
I think alcoholics all over the world have probably nearly died, gotten back up and had a drink the next day, you know? So.
Well, the most fucked up thing I'm hearing about, someone told me a story the other day of like, you know, heroin is obviously a big problem in America right now. And they have, I don't remember the name of it, but there's some thing they give like a person that ODs.
The adrenaline. It's not adrenaline, but I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
And I guess like somebody was dead. They picked up the heroin addict that had OD'd, and they had already OD'd the same day. They had already picked them up and given them the, and then they went out and then they died later that day.
Yeah, that's in a documentary.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's, I mean, you talk about how crazy addiction can be.
Yeah. And I have a healthy distaste for the straight edge rhetoric that's like, when an addict dies, they're like, fucking junkie scum, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, you don't understand the addiction. Or you do understand it and you've lost compassion for the person because you've managed to overcome your addiction. So, I don't know, that it's off topic, but that upsets me. That happened when Amy Winehouse died, and there were some very vocal people, and I was just like, you don't know anything about the inner workings of this human being. Like, this is a person that's just passed away.
I mean, have you heard about all the stuff going on in the Philippines?
Yeah, I mean, they're killing them. They're killing them.
Next level, dude.
Yeah.
That, I mean, wow. If anybody listening to this doesn't know what's going on in the Philippines, they need to get on the Google and... Because that is fucked up. And it's not being talked about over here.
He's compared himself to Hitler.
I read a lot about it in Australia when I was over there because it's you know, closer. But yeah, over here, not hearing as much about it. And it's fucking crazy.
Yeah, that dude's comparing himself to Hitler. Like, in a good way.
What?
Yeah.
My God. That's worse than I thought.
Yeah.
It was something else I wanted to say before we wrapped it up, but... fuck it. Dude, thank you for doing this and taking the time. Have a great show tonight. The Opera House in Toronto, which is my favorite venue of all time. I've literally saw like all my favorite bands growing up here. So
I'm stoked to be here just because of Alexis on Fire and hearing about it.
Yeah,
you know, it's from watching them. So
it's a legendary place, man.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, Joel.
No worries, man. Thank you.
So there it is. My conversation with Joel from the Amity Affliction. It was so great to have him on, and I am so happy for him that he was able to quit drinking, 7 months sober now. He has a beautiful family, and it's great to see the band doing so well in America. Their show in Toronto sounded awesome. I got to check it out, so they're on tour right now. If they're coming through your town, make sure you check them out. They're a great, great band. Next week is a big, big episode. I talked to my favorite lead singer of all time. Yes, I do. So make sure you're subscribed to this podcast. If you don't know how to subscribe, I don't know, Google it. Figure out how to subscribe to this podcast. It will help us out, and that way you won't miss any more episodes. So thank you so much again for listening. I hope you have a great week. Before I let you go, I'm going to play a song by the Amity Affliction, just like we do every week. Here is one of their hit singles, Open Letter, on Lead Singer Cindy. We'll see you next week.